This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Alabama.
Yeah. Send down to us from somewhere up above. They come to you and me in our darkest hours to show us how to live, to teach us how to give, to guide us with the light of love.
I figured we'd start this morning on a positive note, and of course, that's going to be their new intro music to talk about the Chicago Public School teachers, the angels among us, fighting for safety. And we're going to have angry CPS parent, I should say, angry CPS parent Amy Jacobson. She'll be joining us at the bottom of the hour because she's going to be on Fox and Friends with Brian and Steve and the rest of the gang to talk about this very issue, the fact that as we stand here on the beginning of February, we still don't have in-person learning in the Chicago public school system because, well, you know, they're still waiting to talk to one another. That was as of yesterday, the back and forth. This inspires a lot of confidence, doesn't it? First, Lightfoot and Stacey Davis Gates, the back and forth there in terms of who's waiting for whom for the conversations to begin. This is yesterday.
And we've been waiting all day today for in-person negotiations to begin. We've been waiting on the CTU.
We're waiting for them to come back right now. She said that we could do this all night long. So the Zoom is still open.
If only an adult could intercede and end the finger pointing and get to some resolution between who's waiting for whom, and both of you get in front of me right now, you shake hands and you play nice. Superintendent of the school, who's just a flunky for the mayor, of course, that would be Janice Jackson, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty. She whined about this disruption, this latest disruption.
Tomorrow will be the fourth consecutive day where teachers have been directed to remain home. And that makes 15 days in the past year and a half where CTU leadership has disrupted student learning.
Uh-huh, and they're very upset about this. The tag team, the Wonder Twins of Lightfoot and Jackson, saber rattling.
We expect all of our teachers who have not received a specific accommodation to come to school tomorrow.
Teachers and staff that fail to report to school tomorrow will have their access to Google Suites cut off at the end of the business
Ooh.
Day.
Ooh! They're really ratcheting up the discipline, cutting off Google Suites, huh? How do you like that? Now, do you think we're serious? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Just a question, particularly for CPS parents. You really want to send your children back to these people? You want to put your children's education in the hands of people who are behaving as you're witnessing in real time? And I know there are circumstances, I don't want to come across as some out-of-touch elitist. There are circumstances where, because of the property taxes and just the nature of the environment in Chicago, private school is unaffordable. EmpowerIllinois.org. Check it out. Maybe it's not unaffordable. EmpowerIllinois.org, I say again. But even in some cases, it won't be affordable. I get it. The social cohesion piece of it. These are our families and our friends at the neighborhood school. We go together. It's a school I went to. There's a real kinship surrounding the school as an institution. I understand that too. I do. But you have to still answer that question to yourself. You have to answer me to yourself. Do I really want to put my child's education in the hands of these individuals? Now, I'm sure among the 30,000 CPS teachers, there are many, many talented teachers. And maybe your children are fortunate to have such talented teachers. This is never an attack on teachers. I am one who has said for my adult life, a great teacher is like a great artist. And I was fortunate enough to have a couple of great artists during my days in school. But if your kids don't have those few, I would probably guess, great artists that exist in the Chicago public school system, I ask again, you're really fighting or not, or just captive to events, but allowing your child's education to be in these hands. These hands like Stacey Davis Gates and all of her friends. The only S word, no, not strike, no strike.
The only S word you hear us saying here tonight is safety. Make that clear. We want safety.
And also, Jesse Sharkey chiming in, the other S word, Sharkey. He's the head of the Chicago Teachers Union. He's the lead Bolshevik. So a little bit more, a little bit of the other S word, Sharkey, and a little bit more Stacey Davis Gates.
Right now, what they're telling us and what they're telling the world is they're not going to return back into buildings without an agreement that we believe protects our safety.
It is really disappointing, and I don't think that word can be used enough, as well as frustrating that we are here. It is clear to us that everything that we have put forth as an idea for safety is reasonable.
These are reasonable people. Reasonable people. Here's the thing, I guess, if I was having a conversation, maybe if I got invited to be on the Zoom call to ask questions, wouldn't that be fun? That could moderate the discussion. So reasonable. Well, then the vast majority of the other school districts around the country, not to mention so many school districts in Illinois outside of Chicago, they have taken an unreasonable position. They're unreasonable. You're reasonable. This is very much like the conversation we had about winter sports. Up until mid last week, every state but two, New York and Illinois, had figured out how to accommodate winter sports. So everybody else was showing reckless disregard for their children, for the safety of winter sports, but the politicians in New York and Illinois. Is that word to understand? You have the reasonable. I mean, look, you know, a majority or supermajority doesn't make something right, so perhaps you do. I just want to understand it. I just want you to say that what other people are doing different than us is not reasonable, is not safe, is not based on the science and the data, is not accommodating the classroom to ensure that that both teachers and students and the families they go home to are all safe. Yeah, I wish some of these positions that political hacks take, whether those who hold public office or those who hold offices in a union, would be teased out a little bit. And maybe that's something that parents can do. Maybe, as we saw in some of these Zoom calls, like Chicago Unheard, which is supposedly parents of black and brown kids, black and brown families, this is their self-description, focused on speaking up more. Why aren't they speaking up more? Because they're afraid. Well, are you going to look back and say, yeah, I didn't really challenge the quality of education my kid was getting because I was afraid of the teachers' union? I was afraid to stand up to Stacey Davis Gates and Jesse Sharkey. Do you find that will be a compelling rationale looking back? I'm clearly suggesting it won't be. Brian in Oak Forest, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan. So Gizmo's in Orland Park, which is like a kid's casino, is opening its doors on Friday, I believe, the 5th. So why can't CTU figure it out?
I don't know if this. Oh, Brian dropped off. I don't know if this Gizmos. I like the idea though of starting to facilitate children gambling. So I just wanted to know a little bit more about Gizmos. You know, to shepherd them along the way to being proper revenue centers for the state through gambling away their hard-earned money. Greg in LaGrange.
Hi, good morning, Dan.
Morning.
Far be it for me, but I'm an evidence-based guy, and I don't understand. I understand what's going on, but the presentation should be very simple. Here are the facts. This is what we're seeing around the country and across the world in terms of safety and how we're keeping teachers safe and the transmission from children to adults. And there's no abnormal issue here. You save the teachers that are most vulnerable, you reassign them to different duties, and you get the kids back in school so their lives are not destroyed. Lives versus lives, like you always say. And what should be done is just a simple presentation of facts. That will never happen here because we know who runs whom, and we also know there is absolutely no leadership here. So we're stuck in this stare down between two parties that don't want to take any action. And the biggest problem I have here is the media should be pounding these questions home every day. We know our leaders are going to fail us. I mean, it's Illinois, right? I mean, we know. But the media, do we need another example about how they are completely terrible in this town? Just terrible. Terrible.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Well, I mean, Lightfoot and Jackson, I mean, does anybody believe anything they say? We expect teachers to be back in school today, otherwise they lose their Google privileges. They lose their Google suites if they're not in school today. Uh-huh. And then in the same breath, children stay home. You're going to do another day of remote learning. Ooh. But what Lightfoot is counting on is the same thing that previous mayors have counted on, that all people really pay attention to is the banging of the shoe on the lectern, the tough talk. It doesn't have to be backed up with anything. In fact, we know it won't be backed up with anything. You just have to, play your role in this political theater of pretending that that you and CTU are on different sides and that you're not just sort of one consortium of Bolsheviks arguing about who's the top Bolshevik. Oh, and by the way, with respect to the Chicago Teachers Union, I mean, per Greg and LaGrange, you want to have a question or a discussion on the merits, presentation on the merits? Well, yeah, but the merits don't matter. This is of course, not a discussion on the merits. And CTU is not out of their minds. They understand the landscape particularly well. They know exactly what they're doing. They're executing a plan, just as the bank robbers in Heat executed a plan. These are sophisticated political people executing a plan to make sure everybody understands who's in charge. We have the parents, says CTU. Who do you got, Lightfoot? Who do you got? And if you don't think they have the parents, then let me know when there is an uprising in Pilsen or South Shore or Lawndale or Inglewood. Let me know when there's an uprising there, when you're talking about 90% of CPS students that are free or reduced school lunch that are minorities. Oh, and by the way, since this is not only Black History Month, but Black Lives Matter week in so many schools, well, here's a question for discussion in the classrooms or on the Zoom calls, as the case may be. Black Lives Matter. Not in Chicago. Do they?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and I mentioned before the break, it's Black Lives Matter week in many, many schools.
Yay.
Oh.
Hi.
How was your star turn on Fox and Friends?
Oh, yes. I was on there yesterday, and they asked me back today, so it's important. I'm doing this for the children and letting people know out there in this world what their demands are and how ridiculous their demands are. But, yes, it went well. So thank you for asking, Dan.
Very good. It's good. Could find one or two CPS parents to stand up. I mean, the reality is, well, first on the Black Lives Matter thing, Black Lives Matter week in school. Again, you want to turn your children's education over to these individuals and everything you've seen from them. going to be talking about, I'm sure, Black Lives Matter as a movement being nominated for a Nobel Prize. That'll be great. I hope they win.
What are they going to do with $1 million if they win?
I hope they win because I just want to hear the Nobel Committee chanting "Pigs in a blanket, fry 'em like bacon" when Patrice Cullors is giving her acceptance speech. That'll be a fun moment. So much to talk about during Black Lives Matter Week, and it's more than just about Chicago and the Chicago walkout. Don't use the S word. But here's the question that I left off with, which is, in addition to the general tenets of Marxism, how about this for a topic to kick around during Black Lives Matter Week at your kid's school? Do the black men and women in charge of Chicago, and I mean the city government, the county government, the Chicago public school system, at all, do they think Black Lives Matter? By their behavior, not their rhetoric. Does it come across to you that Black Lives Matter in Chicago?
Lori Lightfoot said yesterday 44% of the kids that are missing are African-American children, in Latinx, as she calls it, but I call them Latinos. And that's a problem. If they cared about Black lives, the teachers would get their butts back in school. And that's the bottom line. But they don't care. This is all about them. They're selfish people, and that's...
Well, and the reality is, can we just be honest about it? You know, Chicago is something to point at for most people and say, thank God I'm not there, especially the Chicago public school system. I mean, people really don't care about it, do they? It's a small fraction of parents that are center right in disposition that couldn't get out for one reason or the other. But I mean, it's mostly just minorities and minorities in charge and minority families. So, why not just leave them to their own devices? That's what they want, isn't it? Because they don't want, obviously, the school district to be poisoned by white privilege. So who cares? Right?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, why should anybody be interested? I understand, everybody is sort of back to, I protect my, in these tumultuous times, I just protect my house, my household. I just got to worry about my own. I got to worry about my thing.
Worry about your house before the White House. Yeah.
I think about it. You do have to worry about your own first and foremost. So then why should I make time to care about what's happening in what has become a sewer called Chicago? Why should I care about parents and teachers and administrators and politicians who all clearly do not care about the education of the children in that system based on what they're turning out in terms of the quality of the student?
Well, you should care because you're a good human being, but also you live in Chicago and it affects if you're trying to resell your house. You want a strong school system because that helps.
Not really. Not really. You have a strong school system. It's the private schools. So, if you care about the resale value of your house, you're living in a place where you probably have options in terms of where to send your kids. More likely than not.
Well, the less fortunate children need scholarships.
Yeah, I know. And they need EmpowerIllinois.org. There you go. There's your scholarship. So I'm done. What else do you want me to do? Why should I care? Why should anybody care when the people in charge don't? That's the question.
I mean, did you hear their latest demands? Jesse Sharkey yesterday, last night about 11 o'clock.
Be able to get the board to understand the importance that we have a couple thousand members who live with people in their households. So, a spouse who has a medical condition that would put them at risk of death if the teacher brings home COVID.
Right. Okay. Whatever.
Yeah, and he was talking about hypertension.
Whatever.
If your spouse is
whatever.
Essential workers have had to deal with that this whole time, and they keep going to work.
I know. And this back and forth is so tiresome. I mean, I get it. We're just going to do what they do, just repeat the pat lines. And so what?
I'm saying people should call him out on that because I know some nurses whose husbands have hypertension, and they've been going to work since this whole thing began.
And so what?
Same with restaurant employees and
so
CTA bus drivers.
I know. So you're just going to repeat the pat lines. That's what I said. So what? Everybody said that. Yeah, I know. teachers are holding themselves out differently than other professionals, other frontline workers, and so on and so forth. Frontline, we're well beyond frontline at this point. So what? I mean, you know, but the whole, like, outrage is so cheap today. Don't you get tired? I get tired of saying the same lines, much less hearing them. Don't you?
Yeah.
Anybody?
I get tired of kids committing suicide.
Yeah. So?
I'm tired of it.
And?
I don't know what to do. They don't even have enough psych beds for these kids. I don't know what to do.
Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, Lightfoot dropped the ball. The minute they said, we're not coming back, that's when she gets everybody in the room, the union leaders, everybody, and says, listen, buddy, we're going to fine you, and you guys, nobody's getting paid. Also, kids have to go to school till they're 16. It's a state law. What about the teachers? They're breaking the law. If the kids have to come, the teachers definitely have to come.
Yeah, all right, Jim.
I mean, don't our kids have a fundamental right to education?
Not really. No, you don't have a constitutional right to education. It's just a made-up thing. That's the politician's phraseology. I have a right to health care. I have a right to a job. I have a right to education. You have opportunities to earn education, to work, to obtain health care and so forth. All this, you know, it's just, honestly, I'm going to be as, I don't know, unsympathetic as I can be, because all of the empathy and the outrage amounts to nothing. And it's just can't at the end of the day. Lori Lightfoot, she should fire everyone. Yeah. Is that what she's going to do?
No. She's going to roll like she did again. Now, now it's tomorrow, and then it'll be Wednesday, and then it'll be next year before we know it.
You start the conversations are starting from a premise, as I've said so many times, going back to Rahm, going back to Richard M. Yeah. You're pretending they're on different sides. You're doing their bidding for them with the way this is tackled. And you're going to wring your hands to pretend that you care for 5 seconds and then get about your business. And that includes a lot of CPS parents, clearly, who are beholden, supportive of the teachers' union, supportive of these local politicians who are beholden to the teachers' union. So what? What else you got? I'm bored. I'm not impressed. John in Piatone.
Hi. You know, I'm a union employee. I believe in sticking up for the unions, but why don't we pull a good old-fashioned Ronald Reagan on them and traffic controllers?
I brought that up to Pritzker. He's not going to do
over.
That.
Yeah. We're not. Well, she's not going to get reelected.
Oh, so really?
Well, who's going to win?
Thanks for the call, John. She's not going to get reelected, says who? How do you know that? In fact,
Pritzker's not getting involved, by the way. Just real quick. I asked him Friday. He's like, nope, I'm not. That's the superintendent. That's their issue.
It's a city problem. Well, it is a city problem. It's a local problem.
He's not getting involved.
So, the Reagan and Patco, I heard that a million times, too, over the last many, many years. Same deal. How many strikes have we been through with the Chicago Teachers Union?
1987, 2012, 2019. Yeah. And we just 15 months ago, and here we are again.
And we get the same rhetoric, don't we? We get the same rhetoric from those who stand in opposition to CTU. I called in to the show and I said, fire them all. I told my friend they should fire them all. I did my part.
All right. Well,
yawn.
All right. What could we do? Honestly, I'm open for suggestion, and a lot of people are, too. But if you even say something about them, then they shame you with these internet cowboys call you a white supremacist and a rich white elitist biatch word. You know?
Yeah, that's it's scary to be called a name on social media.
I mean, I'm over that, but a lot of these newbies aren't used to it.
It's too bad. Mary Kay in Western Springs.
I think we all just live in our own little bubbles. All of us do. We're big bubble livers, you know. They're in their bubble. We're in our bubble, you know. It's just that's what's going on. But I was in St. Louis over the weekend, and it's a sewer down there, too. It's not good, Dan. The city is awful. Yeah. I mean, it's not just Chicago. It's all over.
I know. So who cares? Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Who cares? Here's the same dynamic that's at play in Chicago and with the Chicago Teachers Union in your life, because it's everywhere. This is the topic of Barry Weiss's piece in the New York Post over the weekend, 10 Ways to Fight Back Against Woke Culture. And, you know, it's all sort of pedestrian stuff. This is being made much more of in terms of, oh, you have to read this. This is the Bible of how to fight woke culture. Really? Remind yourself right now of following the following truth. You are free. Be honest. Stick to your principles. Set an example for your kids. Worship God more than Yale. Make like-minded friends. Trust your own eyes and ears. Use your capital to build original, interesting things right now. Enough. You have the ability to build new things. Let's go. Yay. Seriously. What are you doing when you see the purge in your world, in your bubble, to borrow from Mary Kay? So forget the Chicago public school system, which most people don't care about, because why should they, for a second. In your walks of life, professional, philanthropic, spiritual, academic, when you see this happening, because I'm sure everybody's been touched by some example of this by now, what do you do? What recommendations do you have? Tell me something interesting, to borrow from Barry Weiss. Jordan in Forest Park.
You know, I think I've seen this movie before. And let's see, a few years ago, the teachers union says we need more money. So what happens?
They go get on more strike.
Money. They got more
and
money.
What happens in the end? They're never penalized for any days they miss. So in this case, Lightfoot has no leverage, zero, because they need to get the schools back, and the teachers union knows it. So all they have to do is, hey, wait, let's wait for a lockdown, whatever. They don't have to go to school, and they still get paid.
So they're pulling for this UK virus to come in and just increase the positivity rate, because they want to control that, too. That's part of their list of demands. They're chomping at the bit for that, or the South African virus, or to come here, too. Sick people. These are mentally ill folks.
They're not mentally ill.
Oh, I think so.
Well, okay, doctor. They're executing a plan. This is a power game. This is power politics. There's nothing. They're ideological. They're Marxist ideologues. And they're saying, we have this power. We control this system. It's perfectly rational. This is, oh, they're nuts. No, they're not. And this is part of the problem. The people that are most involved in this don't even understand the dynamic. Oh, they're crazy. Are they?
I don't know. Here's Stacey Davis
Gates. I don't care about Stacey Davis Gates.
And livelihoods depend on us reaching.
I don't care about Stacey Davis Gates. I was talking. They're crazy. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. They're the highest paid teachers in the country. They're one of the few school districts where the teachers can basically call their own shot in terms of the conditions of work coming back or just in general. But they don't know what they're doing. Oh, really? They know exactly what they're doing. And they know exactly who they're doing it to. And the who it's being done to is the problem. But you can't do that. You can't say that. And you can't address that because we're good people who are outraged. Your outrage amounts to zero. Vic on the north side.
Yeah, I don't understand the public service teachers union. You know, I'm a retired policeman, and we had it written out in our contract. We have a no-strike clause.
Yeah, well, they don't.
The same thing with the fire department.
Yeah, they don't. So what?
Well, I mean, they have to get that changed.
Well,
no, they're not. I mean, if anything, they're going to get more power.
And they have to fire teachers, too. They have to do this. They have to do that. Why do they have to? They don't have to. They do not have to. They show you for generations they do not have to do anything you say they have to do. They do not. And they have not. So what else do you got? Sean on the northwest side.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Good morning. Hey, I just wanted to make a quick comment. You know, all this talk about the Chicago's teachers. And, you know, Amy, have you heard of this new legislation that's going to be passed at the school board?
Yes.
Has already approved is the culturally responsive teaching and leading standards, this new curriculum or this new method of teaching?
Yeah, it's about promoting social justice causes instead of education. Yeah, I saw it. It's ridiculous.
It's going to affect every Illinois school district, and it's not just Chicago anymore. It's everywhere.
All of Illinois.
Yeah, right. That's right, Sean. That's right. We've talked about it many times on this show. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it, I'm sure, later on the show or tomorrow again. And so what? Who's going to stop it? Your duly elected legislators in two chambers controlled by a supermajority fashion by Marxists? Governor Jelly Belly? You on the Northwest side? Somebody in Hinsdale? North Shore? Where? Where's it going? Naperville? Where's it going to be stopped? Have you heard about this? This is terrible. We need to do something. Bang. Done. Over. Next. Marvin in Burlington.
Yeah, good morning. Pretty sad subject.
Yeah, well.
You know, it's not going to change. It's never going to change. And the only thing is when people just don't send their kids there, or the city's so rotted out that it becomes even more of a
dystopian
of a city, right, of Detroit.
Yes.
Yeah, you're going to have people who can afford to send their kids to private school or relocate, and then you're going to have all those that are left that suffer with it. And it's been proven that there's no response from the political class to make any change in decisions, because the voting public doesn't change. They just keep going along and going along. So it's not going to change, and it's just going to continue to get worse and worse and worse.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. You want to know what it looks like to change the paradigm, to just be one person standing up changing the paradigm? Then stay tuned to the show for 6:06 and listen to Tony Roman, who is a restaurateur in Huntington Beach, California. Do something, but don't just flap your gums. Because the people flapping their gums about this and that, or just awakening to what's going on, have nothing to particular important to provide in terms of what they're going to do to take on the Jacobins, whether in the school district or in corporate America. You're just like the politicians. I mean, honestly.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and I know everything is all right with the plebeians in Chicago because restaurants are 25% open. That's all we
have.
Yay.
We've reached phase four. Woo, did anybody have a party?
It doesn't sit well with one restaurateur in Huntington Beach, California, the restrictions on his ability to operate his restaurant. And I thought the example that Tony Roman provided is a pretty powerful one for all of those who can't figure out what they're supposed to do when their business is taken away from them by the government, when their child's education is taken away from them by the government, when they are told what they can and cannot say. They can't figure out what to do. They're confused. Well, maybe Tony Roman can help. Tony Roman posted this video message in lieu of actually appearing in court in California to respond to the citations he has received from the Alcohol and Beverage Control Board in California for operating his restaurant.
By now, many of you may know that we have never complied with any lockdown orders since the very second they were imposed on our state, March 19th, 2020. And most say we have even been provocative in our defiance, not shy about that whatsoever, but instead doing it boldly and proudly when standing for the flag and all it represents. As stated in the first days of our fight, our stand against our government's lockdown tyranny has never been about the right to work, a right to operate a business, having to pay our bills, etc. I understand those needs, but that is secondary. Our fight has always been about something so much bigger than ourselves. Our open defiance has been about only one thing, defending American liberty, our God-given freedoms, those protected under the U.S. Constitution, because it is always possible to recover financial and business losses, but when treasured freedoms are lost, they are gone forever. So instead of running from the lockdowns, we have always felt blessed to have an opportunity to be on the front lines of this fight against the enemies of American freedom. Since day one, we have dedicated our business as a constitutional battleground, and in doing so, we have always been willing to lay everything we have on the line. Risking it all in this important battle, yes, even our very valuable ABC license.
He's got a billboard up that said, leave the mask, take the cannoli.
Which, that's awesome.
Right,
pull, yeah, he's never allowed anybody in the restaurant. Yeah, he's never allowed anybody in the restaurant to wear a mask. Forbids it. Can't come in if you're wearing one.
That is how we fight. We don't follow lawsuits. Our action of defiance is our lawsuit. I will not leave my destiny in this conflict in the hands of courts and judges. We believe they have no standing in this fight against lockdown tyranny. We have four counts filed by the ABC against us to strip us of our license. We have a criminal case against us. We recently had OSHA show up with the police in an attempt to serve a search warrant on us. I personally received death threats from mass shamers, threats to burn our restaurant down, threats to spread viruses inside our restaurant, and even efforts by celebrities to launch boycotts against us. But we have not flinched, and instead have dug in further and continue to hit back harder. We bully the bullies.
And he's not going to court to contest the citations? Why? He doesn't recognize them.
I refuse to appear for my scheduled ABC court hearings today, January 27th, 2021. I reject the invitation to go before you on bended knee to answer for alleged violations of unjust fascist mandates and unlawful orders. I will never use medical exemptions as if I'm presenting my papers to the secret police in the former Soviet Union. I won't use brochures and pamphlets featuring supposed loopholes. I won't go down the rabbit hole with you about the science. You know the facts related to the science already anyways in support of our case. I refuse to use any excuse because that would only justify everything you're doing, giving it credibility. I don't need any of it to make my stand. I only need my God-given freedoms, those also protected under our Constitution. So we'll give no lockdown authority over us to those who have none. Your governor locks up honest working people but releases murderers onto our streets. Run a small business that enriches a community, and they will cut your gas and electricity. He'll riot, burn, and loot your city, and he will kiss your ass.
So that pertains to Chicago, too. That's great.
It does. And what are we doing in response? To run a small business, and they'll shut you down, riot, and loot your city, and they'll kiss your ass. What are we doing about it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I know some restaurateurs per our Tuesday lunch group, the rebeldiners.com, Tom Sedeka and company started. I know that we're supporting the restaurants who are staying open, like Tony Roman, and saying, I'm going to make a living and come and get me, Molon Labe. But what are we doing generally, particularly on the other side of what he said, kissing the ass of people who loot and riot amid all of the moralizing about those who rioted on January 6th. What are we doing locally? Politicians.
I mean, is anybody restaurateur fighting back about this? You know, you can only have up to 25 people or 25%. Why even keep the lights on? Is it even worth it?
You can lose money more slowly. Thank
it's
you.
It's a slow bleed, yes.
Well,
I mean, is anyone going to sit back and take that?
Tony Roman and his Tony Roman's family didn't come from Italy, didn't immigrate to this country from Italy for this.
And now you think you can, on behalf of the tiny tyrant in Sacramento and his mini Gestapo, extort us, threatening to revoke our hard-earned, well-deserved, and very valuable liquor license because we refuse to comply with any of the arbitrary and hypocritical, childish, fear-based, anti-American mandates that his strike teams enforce selectively? Do you understand the wreckage to the country you are enabling? The young people who will never, ever have those cherished experiences of youth most of us had, even turning amusement parks into places where you herd people like sheep to their fear-induced vaccinations. The elderly, you are helping rob of their rightful golden years and precious memories with family, even stealing from them their last moments of dignity, not even allowing proper goodbyes. Immediate members of my family and ancestors before them did not come from Italy to have to deal with Mussolini wannabes who use the pandemic of fear for their own power grab. To be clear, my protest today is on behalf of all American patriots who have yet to find the same courage to fight as we do, but do share the same love for this great country and the blessings it has bestowed upon them.
I know it's not everybody, and not everybody can risk what other people can risk, but what about the Tony Roman example? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Don't just tell me what the politicians are doing. We know that. tell your ignorant, those that are ignorant within your circles of influence what they're doing if they don't understand it. We here understand it. What are you doing? What are you going to do? Because, by the way, the idea that this is just all going to neatly go away after 100 days of mask wearing and the vaccinations receive plus infections generate herd immunity sometime in the midsummer, and then we can resume our normally scheduled lives, doesn't snap back like that. No, just like it didn't snap back after 9/11 and some of the liberties that we conceded, at least conceded infringement upon in the name of safety. Doesn't snap back like that.
No.
And the precedent that's set for the next pandemic or for the characterization of something like the climate apocalypse as a pandemic or the sort of existential threat that requires this sort of unconstitutional unilateral action by executives around the country, then what do you do for the next time around?
I mean, I'm fearful. We'll never have school the same way that it was. We'll never have children because we're these children that are so young, 2 and 3 years old, that are wearing masks. How are you going to teach them undo that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Steve in Woodridge.
Dan, Amy, reference the CTU situation. We should not focus on today. We need to look 10, 15, 20 years down the road when we have a workforce that is low educated, low skilled, and will be low wage worker. We have to change our economy because we won't have an educated workforce.
All right, Steve. Kathy in Shorewood.
Hi, Amy. I'm your former roommate. How are you?
Oh, good. Oh, from Kathy college. Petru.
Petru, yeah.
Yes.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Well, I called in. I saw you on Fox and Friends. You know, my family is going through it, too. I mean, my daughter does go to a private school, but it's been restricted. She has some learning challenges. This type of format is not good for learning challenged students. I also sub in the Joliet Public Schools, and, you know, they're going through it too. Everyone's going through this. But, you know, I'm especially concerned about my daughter. She's receiving behavioral therapy now because sports ended and couldn't start, and she's at a loss. I mean, she had, with social media, a huge addiction. We could barely get the phone away from her.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
So we're going through, I know. So we're going through a lot. And, you know, the callers out there who are calling in, you know, I tell them to, you know, watch their children with social media. They think they're doing a good thing by allowing them to be on their phone so much. But you need more family time.
Yeah.
So.
All right, Kathy,
yeah.
I'll keep you in my prayers.
Thanks.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
love
Kathy.
Love you. Take
appreciate
care.
It.
My sorority sister.
Oh. Isn't that lovely?
Lived with her for a semester. She's a good person.
A little Iowa Hawkeye reunion.
Yes.
Very good. We'll get to my alma mater, Northwestern, a little bit later. And the curious case of a cheerleader who was suggesting she was treated as a sex object. That is not my experience at Northwestern. Randy in Naperville.
Morning.
Hey, Randy.
Hi, Randy.
Good morning. I just wanted to acknowledge that at least the Burmese, and it'll always be Burma to me, military is being upfront and saying their emergency order is going to last a year. Here, we were told everything's under a 30-day order that never ends.
Yeah, it was 14 days, then 30 days, and now we're coming up almost. Yes, it's February 1st. We're coming up on almost a year of this.
Thanks for the call, Randy. You know, it's something that Tony Roman said, too. He's not just talking about his business. He's not just talking about his family. He mentioned about the elderly, about those who are dying and their family is not allowed in to see them, or they're not allowed to get the sacrament of the anointing of the sick. I spoke with somebody over the weekend about pro-life icon who recently passed away. He was in a Catholic hospital, and the Catholic hospital would not let priests trained to provide anointing of the sick in the COVID era in to provide that sacrament to this pro-life icon. Catholic hospital not allowed to do that. Finally, he just his family took him home where he passed away, and then he was able to receive the sacrament before he passed away at home. This is what I'm talking about, a Catholic hospital that believes in COVID over Catholicism.
And not allowing them to anoint the sick. That is disgusting.
A Catholic hospital that is about this world, not the next.
And he didn't die from COVID, right? He was just sickly?
Irrelevant. Irrelevant. We have a problem here. Across every walk of life, we have a problem. This is why the dynamic at CPS, with CTU, or with city and state government, with restaurateurs, or with Catholic hospitals and the provision of a sacrament, it is all of the same kind. Do people not see this? Chris on the Gold Coast.
Hey, good morning, folks. I just want to talk about the next phase of tyranny, which is this, quote, vaccination. These aren't vaccines. These are experimental biotech drugs. And if you take them, you're submitting yourself to being part of their experimental trial for a 24-month period. And while this thing is in experimental status, there are no lawsuits available against these drug companies. So people need to be aware that if they're going to take these vaccines, they're getting themselves into a 24-month trial, and they can't sue.
All right, Chris. Ray in Barrington.
Dan, could you take 30 seconds and tell us more about Empower Illinois? It's intriguing, but I just heard about it last week, and I have a hunch it's been around a lot more than that.
It's been around a couple of years. Thanks for the call, Ray. It's Empower Illinois is an organization that was set up after, during the last gubernatorial administration, they were able to get legislation through the General Assembly to establish a tax credit scholarship program where Illinoisans can donate they can raise through Illinoisans up to $100 million a year for 5 years. And that $100 million a year that's raised, the donor gets a state tax credit, and it creates a scholarship fund for children to go to private schools.
Right. Then who decides who gets to go to what schools? Is there an application process and all that?
Yes, there's an application process. First of all, on the donor side, you can even direct your contribution to the scholarship fund for a particular school. So, for example, I went to Bennett. I could say, here's my $1,000, and I want this to go to scholarships for kids to go to Bennett. Or somebody could do it at Ignatius, or somebody could do it for every school under the sun in Illinois. That's the point. And then, there's so much money available for scholarships at their particular level. I'd have to look up again because I don't want to give you wrong information exactly what the scholarship level is. I think it's around $6,000, but I'll double check that and report back. That's money that the kid and the family can take to apply to the school of their choosing, whether it's from a fund that's dedicated to a particular school or the general fund of scholarship dollars available for Illinois families. EmpowerIllinois.org. I mean, it's like Big Shoulders, and Big Shoulders, by the way, still exists, which was a nonprofit that came together to provide scholarship funds for kids to go to Catholic schools, largely in Chicago. Same concept. It's just a big scholarship fund, but the donors get a tax credit, so this is a way for people to participate in helping to provide scholarships for kids to get out of godforsaken school systems like CPS or U46 or, frankly, Naperville, for goodness sakes. John and Huntley.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm watching Unabomber for the third time in about the last 4 years, and it's striking parallels between what he was railing about and what we now have in this country. And it's not just the FBI and the corrupt U.S. government. It's about the corrupt corporate nature of this country and how people are now being canceled. It's just striking to me. Thanks, and have a good day, guys.
Thanks for the call, John. Randy and Sandwich.
Hey, guys. I think we're at a crossroads here. And when I say that, I say it in this manner. We either can bow down, accept the fact that we are going to be enslaved by this government, and accept their tyranny, and just basically turn this show that you guys have into a cooking show, and give out 50 recipes.
That will not be 4 hours unless Amy has a lot more recipes than I have. All right, go ahead.
You can put Peyton on it.
I'll throw in a goulash recipe if you're willing to accept it.
Very good.
Or we can take the mentality and unite on one issue, which I think we are seeing right now with this GameStop Reddit situation, where these kids, if you will, a lot of them are kids, have united under the fact that they're not going to be pushed down by the bigger groups and the corruptness in the suits. And if you look at that at a broader perspective, it's about freedom. And I believe people on the left, yeah, they might have some radical views, but at the end of the day, I think they want to be free just like we want to be free. And if we can all unite on that one principle, I think then we can overtake this situation.
Thanks for the call, Randy. I'm afraid there are a lot of people that will readily choose comfort. I'm not even talking about security, real security. Comfort, the appearance of security for freedom, which is what you're seeing with safetyism. But in terms of your, you know, your general attitude, I don't really disagree. By the way, just going back to Empower Illinois, I wanted to make sure I conveyed some details here because I was undershot the scholarship. So low-income working class families within 300% of the poverty level, that's the qualifying group, 300% of the federal poverty level. So that gets almost to, you know, that gets, well, it gets to middle-income families. You know, if you're above that, you probably can figure out a way to generate the money for tuition if you really needed to. Tax credit scholarship up to 100% of private school tuition, up to the maximum of the average Illinois cost to educate, which now is roughly $13,000. I was thinking it was just the state contribution, but $13,000, up to $13,000.
Oh, that's great.
For low to middle income families. Students with unique learning needs, including those who are gifted, by the way, English language learners, those with special ed qualification, may be eligible for even larger scholarships, up to double or nearly $26,000. On the donor side, donors eligible to receive a 75% state tax credit to in return for their contribution to this fund. So $13,000 and $26,000 if you have unique learning needs. And I think so far there's something given out something like 15,000 scholarships in the first 2 years, raising more than $100 million. Could raise more money, give out more scholarships, get more kids in lifeboats and out of these terrible school districts.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Only 47% left to go. Brutal. That was one Redditor's post upon the news that Melvin Capital, Gabe Plotkin's hedge fund, that had to be bailed out by Ken Griffin and Stephen Cohen, we talked about last week.
Right.
Only 47% left to go. His reaction to the news that Melvin Capital lost 53% of its money under management in January. Not providing any quarter for the big boys like Mr. Plotkin. Now, the bad news is this impacts Michael Jordan. And we don't like when MJ gets caught in the crosshairs here. Michael Jordan didn't have GameStop shorts, but Gabe Plotkin from Melvin Capital is a minority owner of the Charlotte Hornets, and he reportedly was looking to offload more of a percentage of the Charlotte Hornets to Gabe Plotkin and another minority owner, or sell the team to them outright because he lost like $300 million last year because of the lockdowns and because the Hornets suck. And, you know, the good news
is regrouping, Dan.
Michael Jordan, no red tag sales for MJ. No red tag sales for Michael. His net worth is still like $1.5 billion. But
right, but you don't want anything to happen to him.
No, of course not.
I mean, come on.
We need to do whatever is required. Rewrite laws, provide protections to downside losses, yes. Anything to protect Michael Jordan, of course. But the question is about these Reddit renegades. Are these guys in white hats or black hats? There seem to be divided opinion. Like, for example, former SEC Commissioner Laura Unger, who offered this rather aggressive comparison.
It really puts a lot of question about the integrity of the market, right? And it really kind of, everybody's scratching their heads over this. What should happen? What is the right thing to do to control this or stop this? Not unlike what we saw on January 6th at the Capitol, right? If you don't have the police in there at the right time, things go a little crazy. And that's kind of feels like what's happening with this. Much different, much lesser degree. It's financial harm, not personal bodily harm. But certainly that's the same kind of, you know, platform created frenzy that people are operating under. And these are very trying times.
Short selling for thee, for me, but not for thee. Is that it? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by John Tammany, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, and author of the upcoming book, When Politicians Panicked. Golly, I wonder what that topic is. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So the Redditors who hijacked Melvin Capital, they're akin to the rioters on January 6th?
I wouldn't say that. I question whether they hijacked anything. I think when it all comes out, it's going to become apparent that some pretty large investors had big stakes in GameStop. You know, it was interesting hearing what Unger had to say. She said the police essentially need to be there ahead of time to make sure that these things don't happen in the markets. Well, let me tell you, if you can tell me when a stock is suddenly going to be bid up ahead of time, let's go raise billions.
Yeah, right.
Because we can do it with it. We can do it this morning, and we will become billionaires in short order. The notion that regulation could have somehow fixed what was never a problem in the first place just speaks to the obnoxious conceit of those who operate in government. They are always last to anything by definition, because if they were first to anything, they wouldn't be regulators in the first place. They'd be making money as investors. And
let's take a step.
Arrogance is astounding.
Let's just take a step back for those who aren't in this game. The useful function that shorts play in the marketplace, explain.
They're a very useful function. Shorts take the biggest risks anyone takes in any market, because when they're skeptical about shares in markets that have historically gone up, Americans are optimistic people. We've got great companies or markets. So shorts say the shares are going down. So what do? They borrow shares from an actual owner, pay them a rate of interest to borrow the shares. They enter the marketplace, sell those shares. That's when they're short. They sell them. They pocket the proceeds, and then they sit very nervously hoping that their hunch about the stock going down is correct, because if it goes down, they then go back into the market, buy back the shares that they sold, and return them to the person they borrowed from. Their profit is the difference between when they sold and when they purchased. Now think about what a risky move that is, because if you're wrong, and if you're wrong on GameStop, your downside is unlimited. It can just go up, up, up. But if you're right, your upside is very small. So it's a great trade if you can get it, but there's a reason there are very few shorts in markets, because it's such a risky trade. But they perform an essential function, because they provide pricing honesty. They provide skepticism when markets need it.
And so do you have any sympathy for Melvin Capital and others who got caught on the wrong side of that position with GameStop?
Of course I do. I don't think they should be bailed out. Now, if Citadel and Point72 Capital want to save them, they should. These are private institutions that want to do it. You're always sad to see it. Again, hedge funds, if they didn't exist, that we would have to invent them. They are rooting out pricing anomalies in the marketplace, and the more efficient markets are, the more the economy can grow. And let's point out a crucial thing in what I said about what shorts do. For them to profit, they must re-enter the marketplace and buy back, buy the shares they sold short. So people say, well, short sellers, they just sell things and they profit from it, and they ruin companies. No, 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 no. When short interest in the market rises, that's a signal that there's a big wellspring of buying power entering the market. Because, again, for them to profit, they must re-enter the market and purchase the shares that they initially sold short. And so they're an essential. They put a floor under markets that are on the way down, too, because, again, for them to complete their trade, they must be buyers. They're ultimately buyers always.
But so what about for those Reddit renegades? Do you have any problem with what they did?
No, they have every right to play in a market and speculate in a market. I would just point out to them that if they think this is a trend, that if they think their buying can somehow move shares, good luck to them, because history says that it's hard to make money in the stock market. Who's the owner of Alenia in Chicago? Nick Kokonis, who was a great trader before he owned restaurants. And as he said, if you're a good trader, you're wrong as often as you're right. If you're a great trader, you're right 51% of the time. So there's this assumption now we can band together and beat the big institutions. Good luck. If you think you can do that, you're very quickly going to find yourself with very little money.
Well, don't you think? I mean, they feel empowered and emboldened. I think that they think they're going to take down hedge funds.
Yeah, no, I think they do. And I think that speaks to the concern that Robinhood hasn't expressed and some of these others that cut off trading in these shares. And some of this was obviously capital requirements. But anyone with a clue can look into the future. So people are saying, well, they cut off trading to protect the big hedge funds from more buying. Oh, please. What they reasonably did is they look back to 2000. Remember back in 2000 when politicians were complaining, well, you know, the little guy can't get into these tech IPOs, and that's not fair, and we've got to start democratizing access to IPO shares. Well, that's how they felt until a lot of those IPO shares went south. Again, it's a very risky thing. Does anyone remember the internet bust? Does anyone remember subsequently people being fined and people being hauled before Congress for having the temerity to fund companies that didn't work out? Investing is a very dangerous game. And so imagine what happens if all these retail investors pile into GameStop at, say, 325 and it goes down to 125 and they're wiped out. Does anyone think that Elizabeth Warren and AOC and Ted Cruz and all these other populists won't haul them before Robinhood, before Congress, and say, what were you doing allowing them to buy those shares then? So they can't win either way in this.
And that could still happen, by the way. Some of those that have paper gains, significant paper gains, I mean, a lot of those option contracts won't expire until this Friday.
Yeah, of course. And so they could still lose quite a bit of money. Now, they can sell those contracts now. There's a liquid market for these things, so they can get out. But a lot of retail investors were willing to buy in at any price, and they said the price didn't matter to them. Well, that's what's always said, and that's what was said back in 2000. We want access, the same access that the big institutions have. But recognize that most often, by definition, new companies in a new industry, most of them are going to fail. Can we go back 100 years to the automotive industry? 2,000 car makers formed. Just about every single one of them died. The internet was the same idea 20 years ago, a great new advance that was going to transform our lives, but most of those companies weren't going to make it. And so when you allow the small investor in, you're necessarily putting the small investor at substantial risk.
So talking about the bailout of Melvin Capital, a lot of people are questioning, since the money came from sort of the financial king of New York, Stephen Cohen, and the financial king of Chicago, Ken Griffin, was a call made to Robinhood, or were these titans tipped off that trading would be halted so that they could reposition? I mean, are those we don't know the answers to those questions, but are those legitimate questions to ask?
I don't think they're terribly legitimate, and they aren't, for the simple reason that supply and demand doesn't play as big of a role in stock prices as people think. The assumption is they shut off demand so that the price wouldn't keep going up, 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 up. It's not that simple. And if it were that simple, all you'd do if you were a weak company is you just buy back all your shares, or you would shrink the share count total to limit supply so that the price would go up. It doesn't work that way. A share price is just a market speculation of all the dollars a company will earn in the future for all of its existence. When I was at Goldman Sachs, as an example, the feeling at the firm was that, in fact, there weren't enough shares in the marketplace. And because there weren't enough GS shares being traded, it was holding the share price down because no big institution wanted to hold something that was going to be difficult to unload. You need more float sometimes, more shares being traded so that your price can go up. And so Goldman actually asked its partners to sell more shares, to do a secondary offering to increase the supply of shares in the marketplace. They felt it would be good for the share price itself. So this idea that just shutting out retail buyers who aren't that big of size buyers in the first place was going to somehow limit the rise in the price of shares, I think is probably a bit of a reach.
Well, I was talking to some traders over the weekend, and you know, one of the things that they said is, well, look, we don't know if there was market manipulation or not, but you know, I mean, there's been a lot of instances, and they talk about it, of, you know, of mysterious things that happen in 4 a.m. Before trading opens, and it just sort of historically, and the idea that the biggest players on the market don't have the ability to rig the system to their advantage is terribly naive. And frankly, a leading indicator of that, I thought last week, was Adina Friedman, the head of NASDAQ, calling for more federal regulation. When does the head of NASDAQ call for more federal regulation of markets?
Well, I would say Adina Friedman has done that a fair amount, and a lot of them have pursued more regulation throughout time. And as far as this idea that the big players can rig markets, I submit to you long-term capital. I submit to you countless. The reason there are billionaire hedge fund managers is precisely because the vast majority of hedge funds fail. And so to assume, and Melvin Capital would be an example of another one, Ken Griffin is such an anomaly. The idea, and why do you think he puts so much effort into this daily? This could be his last on a daily basis, too. It's a tough, tough business. And so this notion that the markets can be rigged, well, if they could be rigged, that, again, people have to explain to me why just about every hedge fund, every firm has failed.
All right. John Tamney, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, author of the upcoming book. We'll look forward to this one on the pandemic, obviously, When Politicians Panicked. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. 12 months probation, 400 hours of community service. That's what former FBI lawyer Kevin Kleinsmith got in terms of a sentence for admittedly falsifying evidence submitted to the FISA court for a warrant to spy on one-time Trump foreign policy advisor Carter Page. Is that what justice looks like? For an answer to that question, we're pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of books including Wiki at War and Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, on Kleinsmith, I recall George Papadopoulos going to jail for lying to the FBI. I recall a judge being unwilling to dismiss charges against Michael Flynn for allegedly lying to the FBI. What about Kevin Kleinsmith in the FBI?
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't comment on legal matters. But, you know, I think we all recognize that part of the reason why we have punishments is so that other people know how they'll be held accountable if they do similar behaviors. I think we all recognize that tampering with evidence by a law enforcement official has got to be one of the most egregious things we can imagine, because it literally undermines the integrity
of the entire system of rule of law and equal protection under the law. So I can understand why people would think, well, this does not seem right, because here is a law enforcement officer who, in addition to committing a crime, is a sworn officer who swears to uphold the rule of law. So, you know, for example, when we have an active shooter incident and, a civilian is killed, we have this huge investigation about the participation of law enforcement, use of deadly force. And if a law enforcement officer has exercised deadly force inappropriately, we take that super seriously because they have a double responsibility. They're not just breaking a law. They have a responsibility to enforce the law.
Well, thinking about it at the local level, think about the instances where you've had police corruption, police planting evidence to implicate somebody who was otherwise innocent. I mean, that's really, to me, the comparison to Klein Smith and Carter Page. He essentially created evidence to implicate Carter Page that otherwise he wouldn't have been implicated. And it also not just undermines the FBI, it undermines FISA, too. I mean, I agree with the Wall Street Journal that they asked the question rhetorically, how can the American people take the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court seriously when it doesn't take itself seriously?
I think there's also issue of, justice is blind. So there may have been very well-meaning people in law enforcement agencies who thought, well, these guys are guilty, and for the sake of the nation, I have to help protect the country. That's just a political view. And you're inserting your own political judgments into the exercise of the rule of law. You are not the judge, and it is not your job to determine whether people are coming after the Constitution or not. That's the job of the law. And when you insert yourself into that process, no matter how well-meaning you think you are, you're not well-meaning. You're actually being a political actor, which is not the role law enforcement should play at all.
Right. But I mean, he tried to bring down, he tried to bring down a sitting president. And that's, that's almost, has that ever happened recently that you could remember?
Well, I think that gets to the point is you should not be inserting your political judgments into the exercise of your duties. Look, I was in the military under Bill Clinton. I was in the Pentagon under Bill Clinton. There are a lot of things where I disagreed with what Clinton was doing, but never for a day that I walked in that building did I ever think, what can I do today to undermine this president who I do think is doing bad defense policies? That would be a violation of my oath. So I do think it's a serious issue when you not just commit a crime, but that pursuant to committing the crime that you also violate an oath.
Mm-hmm. It just speaks to the continued skepticism, to be polite about it, that a wide swath of the American people have with respect to the FBI and our intelligence agencies, and I suspect that's only going to deteriorate further over the next 4 years.
Well, I will say, because I work with a lot of those folks. I talk to them all the time. Several people on my staff that have experience in operating these agencies. The people go join the FBI or go to the CIA because they want to serve their country. Whether it's a bad cop or people that get in these agencies and they put a political agenda first, it's not just the American people that are getting victimized, but the good people that work in these agencies are getting victimized for something that they have nothing to do with.
Understand. I understand. But, if there's no operational control of those agencies that is playing the game fairly, so to speak, then, how else do you expect people to react? I don't know. It's just a bad situation all the way around. Christopher Wray, frankly, hasn't inspired much more confidence than did his predecessor.
Again, I think it's an issue. We say, well, that's what we have elections for. A lot of us, right? We think about, well, I'm voting on, I don't like the way they responded to COVID, or I don't like this, or I don't like that. But when you're voting for folks for national office, you're voting for the whole package. You are voting for a commander in chief. You're voting for essentially the person who's the chief law enforcement officer of the land. And, people need to think about these things when they decide who they want to be president. We created the executive office to be strong because we want that affirmation of action. But there's a reason why every single person in law enforcement or in the military or that is a member of Congress or the cabinet, why they all take an oath of office. There's a look, I'm on an advisory board. So I take an oath of office when I join an advisory board. Those oaths are supposed to mean something. You have a public trust. And when you violate that, you've done something really, really wrong. And when you put leaders in charge who are indifferent to people violating their oaths, that's not a positive situation.
Yeah, but it's unsettling. I mean, Carter Page lost his house. He lost his job. He lost his reputation. And this guy, Kevin Kleinsmith, gets 1 year probation. That doesn't seem fair.
Well, it's more than that, actually. I mean, it's the his sentence plus those all of those DOJ Inspector General reports documenting all of this malfeasance and this Durham investigation that doesn't seem like we'll ever see completion on. And you get the feeling you can manufacture evidence as an attorney, as an officer of the court, as a counsel to the FBI and effectively get away with it. And all of those other people higher up can effectively get away with all the malfeasance that Horowitz documented in his IG reports, too. It just doesn't matter if you have the right position and the right connections.
So, I mean, you know, to most Americans, I mean, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't make a legal judgment on this because I'm not qualified to do that. But it looks like a triple standard. It's just not some people are prosecuted and some people are left off. It's, you know, some people are actually hammered and taken to the wall and their lives are destroyed. And then there are, you know, the rest of us just, you know, we get punished. And then there are people who are protected. And that triple standard, I do think, or even the appearance of that triple standard is really undermining to the confidence in democracy. You know, it's funny because the same people who are frustrated, by the way, about the civil rights of individuals on the street, whom they may be treated by a law enforcement who does something wrong, you would think they would be equally agitated about something like this. And to me, this is another problem.
You would think.
We're agitated about civil rights concerns of people who are politically similar to us. But people who are politically indifferent to us, we don't care that their civil rights may have been squandered or their lives destroyed. That double standard isn't healthy for a democracy either.
Speaking of double standards, and I'm old enough to remember when there was a lot of concern about the Emoluments Clause, about the Trump family compromising our national security because of their business interests around the globe. And then this comes to us from Michael Goodwin over at The Post. Joe Biden's younger brother, Frank, appeared in an ad for a Florida law firm for whom he consults, apparently, on Inauguration Day, no less, that was in furtherance of some class action lawsuit they have against a sugar company. The two Biden brothers have a long-held commitment to pushing environmental issues to the forefront, so the ad goes. The president-elect has vowed to rejoin the Paris Agreement and wants to set ambitious greenhouse gas reduction targets. And then there's Frank Biden in the ad. My brother is a model for how to go about doing this work. And again, it's about some class action lawsuit they have against Florida sugarcane companies, this plaintiff's attorney, this plaintiff's firm that Frank apparently is a consultant to. What do you think about that?
Well, again, not a lawyer. You know, I will say I can't ever remember any relative of Trump doing anything similar to that. I think even according to some of the reporting I saw, even Biden was upset about that. So I think that is clearly one that appears inappropriate. So I think this administration should get the same scrutiny. No, it shouldn't get the same scrutiny because much of the scrutiny directed against the Trump administration was actually politically motivated, politically driven, and politically sustained. That's not a lawyer judgment. Well, it is a lawyer judgment because that's what lawyers have said. That's what reports have said. That's not my judgment. So I don't think we want politically motivated investigations, but the level of scrutiny and the standards should be the same for every president, this president included.
Before we let you go, the military coup in Myanmar, in Southeast Asia, this is a country that has had all sorts of problems, including ethnic cleansing, perhaps even a genocide of Rohingya Muslim minorities there, like we see the Uyghurs in China. Any particular interest that America should have other than in Myanmar, other than in opposing dictatorships and genocides?
Well, I think there was always a facade of democracy in Burma that was never really realistic. I think, you know, it is important to recognize and affirm when there are human rights, you know, serious human rights abuses around the world. And I hope we would be really, really strong on that. Look, you know, Burma, I think, is, you know, firmly in the Chinese orbit. It's another reminder of how China is not a force for good in the world. China sustains, nourishes, tolerates, and encourages, in order to keep Burma in its orbit, a military genocidal regime in Burma. That's a reminder to people that China is not your friend.
And for those of you who didn't major in geography like Michael Jordan, Myanmar is adjacent to China. And you're suggesting it's essentially a client state of the Chinese communists, and that they were behind it or sanctioned this military coup.
I mean, there's very little difference in the relationship between China and the way it tries to treat surrounding states like Burma with the Soviet Union and the way it treated captured nations after World War II, like Romania, Poland, and Czechoslovakia, and Yugoslavia. It's very much the same. And again, I think it's when people keep pointing out these problems, whether it's climate change, where the world's biggest polluter is China, or these other issues, and then they turn around and try to pretend that China is some kind of benign or, you know, inoffensive actor. It's not. It is the most destabilizing force in the world today, and that's just the reality of it. And the more we try to treat China like just a normal country, the more we kind of put our head in our shirts and ignore the reality of what's going on today.
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Caravano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always.
Yeah, that's longer than the interview. All right, thanks, man.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, since we were talking a bit about China with Lieutenant Colonel Carafano, this from China.
I thought you were joking.
That's circulating online and on social media. There
is that you bent over, by the way?
Out of an abundance of caution, the Chinese communists are anally swabbing passengers in and out of Beijing.
Hey, we got a live one.
They're not giving up on nasal or throat testing, but they are, you know, really getting invasive when it comes to trying to detect COVID.
Yeah, they're anal swabs that they do at the airport, and sometimes they're taking them to hospitals too, but you have to bend over. And what you tweeted out was, I think it was a dummy, but it was dressed up and bent over on a luggage carousel, because, you know, baggage claims getting really interesting right now, and that's where they do the swab. That's disgusting. I thought you were joking around, but you were serious, because the next thing, they're going to take your temperature that way too, Dan.
Well, I hope so. That's my preferred. Anal testing being used so far only in select groups, high-risk cases, people in quarantine. Some people who have been subjected to the anal testing, including passengers arriving in Beijing, and a group of more than 1,000 school children and teachers who are thought to have been exposed by the virus, according to Forbes magazine. And so, you know, commercial air travel may be about to get more intimate. Look, safety first, right?
Exactly.
It's a great metaphor for COVID, since so much of the response has been asked backwards.
Ayo.
In North Texas, University of North Texas, too, they're not going full Chinese communist quite yet. University of North Texas is the mean green, but they've got some advice and counsel for all the Mr. Green jeans is there. Masquerbate. The school told students to skip sex and stay in. Mask or bait. Use face coverings during mutual masturbation to reduce your risk. The image also that was tweeted out also encouraged students to, quote, be creative with physical barriers and sexual positions to prevent close face-to-face contact. And I think it, I think it also suggested business. This music to accompany the masturbating. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Talk about it with your partner. Let's talk about sex. Pick a large and well-ventilated space. Avoid kissing. Wash your hands before and after. Well, I isn't that
well,
normal
of course.
Protocol?
Hand sanitizer in between too.
We'll have to get Dr. Ruth
this
Westheimer
is new to
on
you?
To
okay.
address this. I thought those were the normal protocols for those sort of carnal relations, but. Yeah, so there you go. North Texas University, your kids' colleges and universities leading the way with proper COVID policy.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Report on Trump's impeachment trial team that the South Carolina crew left, and they've been replaced by two attorneys that he announced through his office of the former vice president that he stood up email yesterday. Interesting that the initial report over the weekend, Palm Beach friend who spoke to Trump and his inner circle, quote, he'll let Bowers, this is Butch Bowers, the South Carolina attorney who was going to head up the defense team. He'll let Bowers handle the trial in a straightforward way without litigating the election fraud stuff. The president will be acquitted again, and then he'll use his two acquittals as a badge of honor with his base. Well, since that statement was made, that Palm Beach friend must not be up on things because Bowers is gone, and so were some of the colleagues that he put together. And part of the reporting is essentially there's an argument internally between raising the issue of allegations of election fraud versus just litigating the narrow matter of did the president incite violence, that being the stronger case for the president to make, that being essentially the article for which he was impeached. And based on the vote in the Senate last week, there's not the support needed to convict. So let's just go in the direction that we're strongest, and that would be that direction. But for more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Matthew Boyle, Washington political editor for the Breitbart News. Matthew, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Do I have that about summed up? Where does the president stand with respect to the legal strategy next week?
Well, look, none of this really matters, right? Because the U.S. Senate voted this past week. Senator Rand Paul forced a vote on whether or not the trial itself is even constitutional. So all of this now is just politics. All of this now is just a political song and dance. We had 45 Republican senators stand with Rand Paul last week to vote to say that there shouldn't even be a trial because it's unconstitutional.
Yeah, yeah, but
former President Donald Trump is not the president.
But it does matter. It does matter. I mean, if I'm a Republican senator and you come in with Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood talking about Dominion and Hugo Chavez and so on and so forth, you may force me into a position I didn't hold a week earlier. So actually, the quality and the choice he makes matters. Not in just in that context, but it matters for his ongoing relevance.
Yeah, it does in that respect. But at the end of the day here, like the big picture here is the Democrats proceeding with this trial with the understanding that they know they're going to lose. Right. So the political situation here on the ground is the Democrats know they will not get 17 Republicans in the United States Senate to vote for the conviction of President Trump on the article of impeachment that the House passed. So why are they moving forward with it? And that's the story. I mean, we had Democrat Senator Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's old running mate, coming out and saying that he thinks it's a waste of time, that he thinks the whole thing isn't worth pursuing. Now, he still supports going forward with it, don't get me wrong, because that all the Democrats do. But the big picture here is, again, the Democrats know they're going to fail on this vote. They need
right,
to,
but
to
if get he, but if it's like vote. A circus, if it's a circus atmosphere, though, you can't be guaranteed anything. And don't you want the former president to have a strong defense and a strong legal team?
Yeah, sure.
And
you
to
want
just
the president
focus
to
on the inciting violence charge?
Yeah, you want the president to have a strong defense. We'll see how these lawyers do. I think they'll be okay. So, but I as long as it isn't Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood representing the president, as long as it is, you know, one of these serious attorneys, and it looks like the president's going to have a good team around him. So, you know, you can swap out the guys from South Carolina, put these new guys in. These new guys seem okay. So there doesn't really seem to be anything wrong with them. But again, a lot of the whole bigger picture here is, again, the Democrats are not they know they're going to fail. They're proceeding with it anyway for political purposes.
Of course.
And then meanwhile, the problem for them is the vast majority of the American public out there are still struggling with this coronavirus pandemic. And they're watching Washington play this political game on something that they know they're going to lose on. So the average American out there can wait till March or April for a coronavirus relief check so that Washington, D.C. can play its politics games against former President Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean,
when they know they're going to fail.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to serve your base, and that's who they're serving. And so, and I mean, you know, the checks, the people are still waiting for their checks from the $900 billion COVID relief dump. And now we're going to get another $600 to $2 trillion dump and so on and so forth. I mean, I don't know who thinks they're necessarily gaining any political ground by just continuing to print money and distribute it on top of previous checks. But OK, with respect to Trump, though, going back to the trial, perhaps the way he spikes the football is just by presenting no defense at all. Your Honor, we rest and call the question.
Well, I think they should go back to his speech. I mean, there's no moment in Trump's speech on January 6th where he encourages anybody to engage in violence or to storm the Capitol. Like, I mean, there's no moment in that speech where he says, break into the Capitol and go stop these people or something like that. He doesn't say that. And by the way, the other thing is they should also show the stories of there were a 250,000 people here in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. The vast majority of them were very peaceful, good, decent, honest people. You should tell those stories. You should tell the stories of the many, many, many people that didn't go engage in storming the Capitol. There were only 200, 300 people that actually went into the Capitol.
On the matter of the impeachment, those 10 Republicans who voted to impeach in the House, you've had Tom Rice. He was just censured by the South Carolina Republican Party. He was one of the 10. There is a movement afoot in central Illinois to censure Adam Kinzinger, who's one of the 10. And of course, one Wyoming Republican Party also already censured Liz Cheney, who already has a primary opponent, who, as you reported, is already lapping her in the polls. I mean, Liz Cheney is dead woman walking politically.
Yeah, so I've never seen anything like this in a decade plus of covering anti-establishment politics. It's unbelievable to me. She is trailing her primary challenger, 54% to 21%. Wow. This is the daughter of the former vice president of the United States. This was a poll done by actually President Trump's political operation. His pollster, John McLaughlin, did this poll, and then released the memo.
Of course they did.
Poll, yeah, 54% to 21%. Now, this is, again, the daughter of the former vice president of the United States. She's chairwoman of the Republican Conference, so the number three official in the House Republican leadership. And again, just won re-election just a few months ago. And now all of a sudden, just a couple of weeks removed from her decision to vote to impeach, you know, then President Trump, now former President Trump, she has fallen 30 plus points behind a just announced, fairly not very well known primary challenger. That means that the people of Wyoming are very, very mad at her. I don't see how she survives a primary down the road. She also has now lost, apparently, and we've talked to several members of Congress who confirm this. There are at least more than half of the Republican conference once are gone as chairwoman of the conference. So she's definitely in big trouble. We'll see what happens. There's going to be a big meeting of the Republican conference on Capitol Hill on Wednesday morning, later this week. So I talked to some sources up on Capitol Hill over the weekend. They say there may be some action that happens there. So we'll see how that plays out. But I don't know how and when and you know what exactly shakes out with Liz Cheney's future. All I will say is that it's hard to see in a couple of years her coming back to Congress after the next election. So I don't know if she loses a vote for conference chair, if there even is a vote. What that you know, what the intra conference fight looks like, but the pathway is kind of set here for Liz Cheney. She is headed in a very bad direction for her own future. It doesn't seem like she's going to be coming back, and it seems like the end is near for her. The question is how and when does that happen? And also the same goes for a lot of the rest of these other 10 Republicans. Kinsinger, as you mentioned, there in Illinois, Rice down in South Carolina. A lot of these folks seem to be in some serious trouble. Some of the ones that are in more battleground districts, like there was one guy out in California, Valadao, he might be actually be okay, like some of those ones. But the ones that are in red areas, like Cheney in Wyoming, like Rice in South Carolina, and if I'm not mistaken, Kinsinger's district is a pretty Republican district. So, I mean, those guys are going to probably face some serious consequences politically for this. In the case of Liz Cheney, she's definitely in big trouble.
And what's the play of the 10 Republican senators who sent a letter to Joe Biden saying, let's do something smaller than $2 trillion in the next COVID relief? We haven't even the $900 billion we just passed isn't even out the door yet. You want to throw another $2 trillion on it. But to suggest that another $600 billion is warranted, but $2 trillion isn't, seems like they are playing on the left's turf of just printing money and throwing it at the COVID response.
Well, look, we want to see if Republicans are involved in negotiating a coronavirus relief plan, they can help steer it in the right direction. So, because if they're not involved, then the Democrats are going to do it via reconciliation. The Democrats have a majority, slim one, in the Senate, 50-50 Senate, and they have the House, too, a six-seat majority over there. So they can ramrod through a reconciliation bill, at which point they would do things like last night there was a story, I think, that came out in Politico that 100 House Democrats have written a letter saying that they want to include an amnesty for 5 million people in for illegal aliens, 5 million of the many more illegal aliens that are in the country, in a coronavirus relief bill that they can pass via reconciliation. And they made the argument for it. So if Republicans are involved in the negotiations, they can stop things like that from getting into the bill, and then it's going to slow down the broader push for an amnesty that the left is going for. So I do think that it's good that Republican senators are going to be engaged in these negotiations. Now, look, there's certain lines that they shouldn't cross. So if the but at the same time, if they can extract some concessions from the Biden administration on this and steer the package in the right direction, probably a better thing to do than letting the left just ramrod through crazy nonsense. But the fact of the matter is, this is a Democrat Washington. The Democrats control the Senate, they control the House, control the presidency. And so until the Republicans get the majority back, I mean, you know, they're setting the legislative agenda on the left. And so That's the fact of the matter. So hopefully the Republicans are able to steer it at least a little bit in the right direction.
Matthew Boyle, Washington political editor for Breitbart. Matthew, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and see this story out of Peru. Attorney on a Zoom call representing his client who was under indictment for gang-related activities, land trafficking, extortion. He was having sex with a woman while he was on the Zoom call about his client's status hearing on that client I mentioned who's got the gang-related charges. The judge during the session, they were all watching, "We are witnessing obscene acts which represent a violation of public decency and are aggravated by the fact that they are being recorded nationally." Yeah.
Hey, a piece of advice, don't multitask.
Yeah. Hector Paredes Robles is the attorney in question. He has now been barred from any more involvement in the ongoing case. I'm sure his client probably wants a new attorney. In addition to that, he's going to face two separate probes. He might like that. One by state prosecutors, another by his local bar association. Sure. No word yet whether or not he is going to start a firm with Jeffrey Toobin, a former CNN legal analyst. We'll let you know on that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. These are interviews that are difficult to do, but when parents speak out, we feel obligated to amplify their message. 10 days ago, we spoke with Chris Buckner, the father of Dylan Buckner from Glenbrook North, who committed suicide during these lockdown policies, and Mr. Buckner and his wife speaking out on behalf of restarting sports again because sports were so important to Dylan and are so important to so many other kids as a school generally.
Well, yeah, sports and theater and dance and all of that.
And
clubs.
And so the situation is with Lisa Moore, who we talked about a bit last week after she appeared on Harris Faulkner's show on Fox News to discuss the death of her son, Trevor. And we're pleased to be joined now by Lisa Moore. Lisa, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. So just tell us about your 18-year-old son, Trevor.
Boy, how long do you have?
Yeah, I know.
My son, Trevor, was awesome. He was a total extrovert, not happy unless he was performing of some sort. At Seneca, he was a freshman at University of Illinois when he took his own life in the dorm. At Seneca High School last year as a senior, he was the president of his class. He was president of National Honor Society. He was the captain of cross, the captain of the speech team. He was the drum major. He played the trombone. He was in choir. He had an awesome voice. He was the lead in the spring musical, which thank goodness was able to he was able to perform. It was the weekend before they closed the schools for COVID. Numerous clubs. I mean, the list is endless. He is a sophomore year high school. He was a representative at the Hobie, which is an honor government camp. His junior summer, he went to Boys State, which is also an honor. So he met children or kids from all over the state of Illinois. He was awarded the Daughters of American Revolution Award. He was the only boy in LaSalle County. Yes, it was kind of funny.
Well, Lisa, you and I spoke at length this weekend, and by all accounts, he was just an amazing student and the teachers still miss him and everybody in your community misses him. But tell us how, when the lockdown first started, what changed in him?
I just saw like the light kind of go out in his eyes. Trevor was at school most days from 7 a.m. till, if he had musical practice, till 9 p.m. You know, it was his world. It was his everything. He had such a great rapport with his teachers. He besides being educators, they were, you know, his friends also. He would tell me the Zoom stuff is just, it's horrible. It's not the same, you know, and there's no extra help, no extra classes that you can go to, because so many of the educators at Seneca High School host on their own time study groups and study periods for, you know, some of the upper level, like AP Calc class per se. And none of that could go on. I mean, he just, you know, he went from just being just a light and a singing, dancing machine to he just was sad. He was very sad.
It's interesting because this sounds very much like our conversation with Chris Buckner about Dylan. You know, Dylan was a standout athlete, also a standout student. Your son, a standout student, a standout in theater and the arts, and he's involved in all these activities. And it's the same dynamic. It's that they were making those interpersonal connections that mean so much in life, particularly for young people finding their way. And for all that to be taken away so quickly, it's not, people shouldn't be surprised that some of these kids, no matter how well they're doing in so many fronts, are lost when that happens.
Exactly. And Trevor also was an athlete. He was, you know, like I said, he was on the cross country team that made it to state many times. Right. He also was looking forward to his senior year, his track season. He was a pole vaulter. He made it to state his sophomore year, which he PR'd at state, which is rare. He did not make it his junior year. He missed by 3 inches. That was just devastating to him. So, boy, he was so gung-ho for his senior year. He could not wait to get back jumping again and make it down to state and just, you know, do his best and all that. So when that was cut, it was hard. It was very hard for him.
So what was the situation when he moved on from Seneca High School to U of I?
Trevor wanted to go to a bigger school. He really did. He was very hopeful to be in the marching band. He was planning on being in the marching band at U of I until he found out that it was just Zoom. You know, Zoom practicing, and he's like, Mom, I don't want to stand and practice my trombone to a computer. You know, he wanted to do it for the camaraderie of the band and just the excitement and just all of those things. So he did not do that. He moved into his dorm. He was positive. He was going to give it a try. He wanted to do it, you know, and everything, but he didn't have a roommate, which we found out after a few days because his roommate was coming from India. And obviously he couldn't come because of COVID. Mm-hmm. That was hard, you know. So he was starting to, you know, when you are a freshman in college, sometimes your roommate ends up being your best bud or at least someone to hang around with all the time. Well, he didn't have that. Everyone had to wear masks.
He was essentially locked in his room, right? I mean, because they had no in-person classes.
Well, he had 2 in-person classes. The rest were online. But the 2 classes he did have a person, he was fortunate. I mean, they were upper level history classes. So everybody that was in it knew each other pretty much, except, you know, he was a freshman. Plus wearing a mask, plus sitting 6 feet apart. You don't forge relationships like that. It was very difficult for him. He had to sit 6 feet apart at tables to eat, you know, with your mask on, just off to eat. And they sat outside. The tables were outside until it got too chilly in the morning for them to eat breakfast outside, and then they brought him in. There was, you know, no clubs, no activities in person. Everything was via Zoom. So that's another thing, hard to forge new relationships when you're just meeting someone over the computer. And it's just, it was all very impersonal. However, they COVID tested them 3 times a week. They all had to be COVID tested. So they knew if anyone had the virus or not, you know, but they did not loosen the chains on anything. It's just, it was hard. He was trying his best. You know, we talked to him all the time, myself, his dad and siblings, and he kept trying. And, you know, he would try to meet people and try to get out there, but it was very hard. And when you're alone all the time and then alone in his room, and there was only three floor meetings since he was there. So in 8 weeks, three floor meetings, and they were via Zoom too. So,
well, I think that this is what people don't know, that, you know, we were sending our kids to college, but even at U of A, I've heard this, at Iowa, you're locked in your room. If you have a roommate, fine, but you have to do your whole classes online and there's no social interaction. And yet you're paying these exorbitant fees. And I know at a lot of Big Ten schools, they took the second semester fees and then they told them that it's going to be all remote learning.
Wow. I honestly think if they weren't prepared for this, I don't think that they had, you know, and I'm not blaming the RAs, but they didn't have enough, you know, enough education for this whole COVID isolation, this whole changes in people's moods, and just they were not prepared. I don't think U of I should have opened. I think Trevor should have just had to stay at home.
So this wrongful death suit that you filed against Governor Pritzker, what's the message you're sending the governor?
Well, I don't think exactly a wrongful death suit. It's been those words per se. I just would like to know why he just made the decisions he made so quickly without any evidence-based, you know, theory behind it. Why he just closed everything, boom, the schools, and negated just the kids' feelings and didn't see forward how all this was going to happen with this COVID isolation, with the kids being depressed and the mental changes. And I don't think we've seen the worst of it. I think the PTSD from all of this with all these kids, it's going to be horrific. Kids are finding other things to do when they're not involved in their normal activities, and they're not always making the best decisions. You know, I've heard stories of drinking and just different things that are going on that wouldn't probably be had the kids been busy doing what they're supposed to be doing in school.
Your conversations with other parents and families at Seneca High School about you know, what's happening there, just within your universe of Trevor's friends and those moms and dads that you speak with.
What was the question?
What has been the interaction with, you know, Trevor's friends and families that you were friendly with, the other parents of Seneca High School, you know, where you live, and their reaction, what other families have been dealing with in your community during these lockdowns?
Oh, well, regarding Trevor and what happened with him, everyone was devastated, shocked, very surprised. I mean, and then the realization hit, if this could happen to Trevor, it could happen to any kid, because of who Trevor was and the impact and just everything he left with anybody. Anyone that met him once remembered him. At his services, I think I counted 12 high schools that had attended, different high schools. And some of these kids had only met Trevor once, maybe at a cross meet or at a speech meet. But his impact on their lives was enough that they wanted to come show their respects. Parents are worried. Parents are very worried about their kids. And this is helping them be more alert, being more attuned to their children's, you know, behaviors and just any differences they're seeing in their kids. I tell every parent to helicopter the heck out of your kids now. Just watch for anything. Be aware, you know. Trevor and I were very close. We talked about everything. And, you know, when I asked questions, it's not like I didn't. I asked questions. He just did not share at the very end how sad he was.
And then, Lisa, you had a fight with the University of Illinois to get the tuition back?
Yes, I did. They did send me, in the beginning, they sent part of it they gave me back. I can't think of the word. I apologize.
That's all right.
But I did have to get downright ugly in an email asking them if they could sleep at night, because I sure couldn't, because the images of my son and dad in his dorm room didn't allow me to sleep very well. And then they finally did issue me a check for the rest of the money that we had spent for his first semester.
Well,
I think...
Yeah, no, I understood. Well, one thing is what you were describing in terms of all those kids and families represented at his funeral service. That's a great testament to your son. So that's you know, it's a great indication of the legacy that he leaves behind. And I hope parents are listening to you and unfortunately what you have to share. And we certainly appreciate your time in sharing that as well. And good luck with your effort to get some accountability from the governor. Nobody else has been able to do so, so maybe you can.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I appreciate you speaking with me. And yes, I just plead to the parents to watch your children, because I don't want any other family to go through this. This is horrific. This is the rest of my life. I wake up every morning and it's just a realization that that boy is not going to come walking back into my room singing, dancing, being his silly Trevor. And I know he's reaching out through me. He's telling me, Mom, there's kids that are still sad in their dorm rooms. They don't know what to do. There's kids sad at home. You know, they're missing their friends. They're missing their sports. Please, Mom, help them all. And I am. I'm Trevor Strong.
And Lisa, I'm telling you, well, our thoughts and prayers are with you. But I truly believe in my heart that that lawsuit that you filed with the other parents against Pritzker and the IHSA helped a return to sports, because there were games played this weekend south of I-80, football games that, you know, regions that were in phase four. And I thank you for that from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, I sure hope it helped. And I sure hope it's going to help get everything out there. I sure would like to see some plays and musicals go back on, because the sports are all important. I agree. But there's other kids that might just be looking forward to that musical or to that play or to drama club, just anything mm-hmm. extracurricular. And it all needs to open back up for these kids.
Absolutely. Trevor's mom, Lisa Moore. Lisa, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. You guys have a good day.
Thanks. You too, Lisa. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer.
Dan and Amy, very difficult interview with Lisa yeah. Moore. Text from 815. I feel really, really bad for the lady, but what did kids do 100 years ago when they didn't have any of these activities?
Oh.
Well, I mean, you know, just to address that, I understand. Where kids weren't locked in a room 100 years ago. Well, I don't know what they did. They worked. But we had sports 100 years ago, by the way, or 200 years ago. They interacted with other children in their neighborhood.
Yeah, they worked on their family farm.
40 years ago, we could just go out and play kickball or hide-and-seek or whatever and all day long, and we didn't have to worry about these things.
Went home when the sun went down, right?
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, I think because we don't have a real understanding of it, and because suicide is such a mystery, we suggest, well, you know, why is this happening to this person who has everything going for him? You know, it's hard to understand the psychology of a particular individual, a particular young person. But the fact is, what we're seeing happen is what we're seeing happen. And what's changed, and obviously, as I said before, the change is that the prohibition on interpersonal contact, which is an integral part of the human experience.
Yeah.
It's what makes us human, interpersonal and intellectual connections. And the government has removed at least one of those for extended periods of time. And it's hard to know how that presents itself. It varies individual to individual. But if we're going to talk lives versus lives, then let's talk about it. What do you say?
Mm-hmm. Got another text message, Dan and Amy. I'm crying in my office right now. I can't imagine her pain. Thank you, too, so much for putting these parents on to show people that we need to check on our children.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, the Lightfoot press conference and the Chicago Teachers Union Zoom call. I mean, the scripts write themselves, for goodness sakes. Yesterday, the debate was about when they're going to have negotiations. I'm waiting. No, I'm waiting. Lightfoot and CTU political hack Stacey Davis Gates.
And we've been waiting all day today for in-person negotiations to begin. We've been waiting on the CTU.
We're waiting for them to come back right now.
No,
she
we're
said
waiting.
That we could do this all night
Dana,
long.
I'm waiting for
so
you.
So the Zoom is still open.
And then you get
the Zoom open or closed.
You get the customary saber rattling from Lightfoot and Janice Jackson, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
We expect all of our teachers who have not received a specific accommodation to come to school tomorrow.
Teachers and staff that fail to report to school tomorrow will have their access to Google Suites cut off at the end of the business day.
Oh, my. Oh, cutting off the access to Google Suites. Wow. They're really dropping the hammer now. And then over at the Bolshevik Union, you get the safetyism. Here's the only S word that Stacey Davis Gates is talking about.
The only S word you hear us saying here tonight is safety. Make that clear. We want safety.
There's one more.
I thought it was going to be strike.
There's one more S word, and it's Sharky with more Stacey Davis Gates as a kicker.
Right now, what they're telling us and what they're telling the world is they're not going to return back into buildings without an agreement that we believe protects our safety.
It is really disappointing, and I don't think that word can be used enough, as well as frustrating that we are here. It is clear to us that everything that we have put forth as an idea for safety is reasonable.
They're reasonable people. This sure. CTU, City Hall Political Theater, has had a longer run than Cats. And frankly, I'm tired of hearing the new players recite the same played out lines. So let's try a fresh script. And to help us with that, we're pleased to be joined by Paul Vallis, former superintendent of the Bridgeport Public Schools and the Recovery School District of Louisiana, former CEO of both the School District of Philly and CPS, and former budget director for the City of Chicago as well as a mayoral candidate in 2019. Paul, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So here we are again. And so,
I know.
And so what would you be saying if you were to be able to fill in for Janice Jackson for a day, whether or not Lightfoot wanted you to say it or not?
Well, what I would have done in September when they demanded that they go full remote is I would have voided the contract because that was in violation of the contract. And it actually was in violation of state law because there are a number of things that they can't strike over, and reopening the schools is not one of them. So I would have simply violated the $1.5 billion contract that the school district cannot afford. And I would have basically said if they do not return to work, they do not get paid. And I would have predicted that within about 2 weeks after they would have exhausted a number of their sick days or vacation days, the teachers would have returned to work.
Now, to be able to do that, what you just suggested, as a school superintendent, whose backing would you need to affect that?
Well, you have the right to do it. So it's not like the city council can veto the mayor doing that because the mayor appoints the school board. The city council has no role in the governance of schools, number one. I mean, they can pass resolutions all they want in support of the Chicago Teachers Union. Of course, the state could potentially intervene, but the law is clear on what the union can strike and not strike over. And you know, given
but to be clear, you would have needed the mayor's backing to do that.
Oh yes, absolutely,
right, exactly. Because I just want to highlight that because all of this, you know, Lightfoot was part and party to the shutdown of the school and all the Zoom learning and all the capitulations to the unions. She acted in reckless disregard of the truth for the entirety of the last calendar year. Now she's saying she wants to open up schools like other big city mayors for political reasons. And some people are trying to ascribe credit to her just because she's not the Chicago Teachers Union, when in point of fact, she deserves no credit.
Well, look, you know, the bottom line is the mayor's office has almost unilateral authority over the schools. So it's her fault that they struck they went remote in the first place. And if schools are not open, it's because she's refused to act. And she has consistently backed away. She's drawn the line in the sand about, I don't know, a half a dozen times. And every single time the union calls her on it, she backs off.
Now they walk all over. And now, I mean, they could have come out and said, if you do not show up for work today, we are going to, you know, suspend your Google classrooms and we are stopping paying you. But I never heard that part of the conversation. They just said that we're going to cut you off.
And they could have done it in September. And look, I'm visiting my son in Texas today. He's a police officer in San Antonio. Of course, the schools have been open to hybrid models since September. 76% of the school districts in Illinois have been open, or either fully opened or opened using hybrid models. Look, I don't care if they open tomorrow. I don't care if the union has a epiphany and they decide to take an interest in the children's welfare for the first time and open. It's a lost school year. Mm-hmm. The union has so poisoned the ground by convincing poor parents and many of their members that schools are unsafe through their propaganda, through their constant disinformation campaign, that even if the schools open tomorrow, only a fraction of the students would come back. And, you know, and so at the end of the day, it's a lost year. And also remember, there is no plan to reopen the high schools. Meanwhile, every day, 100,000 high school kids are wandering the streets of Chicago. And we see it in the escalating murder rates, the escalating shootings, and, of course, the emerging teenage carjacking industry.
Those are all salient points. And so what about additional measures to rebalance power here, to exercise the leverage that your statutory power actually confers, which is to send a message to the 30,000 by, for example, riffing 500, 1,000, especially since you're only going to have 40% of the kids return, even if, as you said, they started tomorrow. Well, we need fewer teachers, so we're going to go per the contract, and 500 or 1,000 of you are gone, and we'll do more to send a message that it's more than just idle talk this time around.
Well, what I would have done is to freeze all the vacancies and to begin to move to eliminate those positions, because there are positions like at the high school level. If high schools aren't going to open, and if they're not going to be offering these elective credits online, do you think they're offering the array of electives, of these meaningless electives, to the high school students remotely? No. So there are teachers that are absolutely doing nothing or doing very little. So why even keep those positions? Why not use that money and convert it into work-study programs for these kids? The city controls $24 billion in budgets from multiple agencies, and the city could have easily set up work-study, Crystal Ray-style work-study.
That's an idea.
Kids off the street and engaged.
That's a good idea.
You know, there's no leadership here. There's no leadership here, Dan, and the school year for all practical purposes has been lost. And remember, this is a district that has lost enrollment for 17 consecutive years, and 44% less black students enrolled in preschool programs and 30% fewer Latino students. That's going to have a catastrophic impact long term, because the population, the school population, particularly the poor children, are so in need of early childhood educational services. So permanent damage is being done, and that damage is not going to be repaired. So at the end of the day, she's just caved so many times. The union thinks that they can act with impunity because there are simply no consequences.
So, but here's the deal. So if they go virtual, if they cut off access to virtual classrooms at the end of the day, like they said that they would, then the CTU says that's going to trigger a teacher strike. But is that an illegal strike, correct, according to the contract? Because we just went through this 15 months ago.
You know, it is an illegal strike. And what I would have done, given the indecisiveness of the state, what I would have done is simply, first of all, cut off pay. Teachers will return to the district. I would have said, basically, there is no union contract. If teachers return to school, I will respect the provisions of the contract for individuals who have, in fact, returned to school to work. And then I would have basically waited. And I'll tell you, you know, after spending about 2 weeks of vacation days or sick days or whatever, I believe most of these teachers would have returned to work. But, you know, so much has been lost so far. I mean, as I mentioned, not to be redundant, even if schools reopen tomorrow, the high school kids, there's no schedule for the high school kids to come back. And again, the members and the parents have been so intimidated by the teachers union. There are many teachers who'd like to come back, but they're being intimidated by their other members. And there are many parents who would like their students, their children to return. But, you know, if they go on Facebook or if they try to ask questions within their schools themselves, they are shouted down. And sometimes they're called elitists, and a lot of times they're called racists. So at the end of the day, serious damage has been done. And it's truly unfortunate because, you know, here's a startling statistic that people should be fully aware of. Not only has there been an exodus of people from the city, there's been a massive middle class exodus. Only 16% of the city today is middle income. And the exodus of black families, particularly black middle class families, since 2010, 264,000 black residents have left the city of Chicago in the last 10 years. And the overwhelming vast majority of those black residents have, in fact, been families, middle income families with children. So people are trying to get out of the district as desperately as possible. That's why the district blocks school choice. That's why the union is opposing, has capped the expansion of charter schools, because they want to hold these children hostage. And people are voting with their feet.
So, I mean, I think that's a great summary of exactly what's happening, because that's what's happening. And by the way, it should continue to happen, because your child is not there to serve the system. The system is supposed to serve your child. So empowerillinois.org, scholarships available, $13,000 per kid, $26,000 if they have unique needs. Empowerillinois.org, I'll say it again. It seems to me, Paul, with where you have the situation with the personnel on the fifth floor at City Hall, and then by extension in CPS, and the Chicago Teachers Union demonstrating to everybody yet again that they run the system for their benefit, that until and unless you get a revolt inside that union from that fraction of teachers who want to go back and who know better than the Bolsheviks at the top of it, in combination with parents in neighborhoods like Pilsen and Inglewood and South Shore, that you're not going to see anything change in the Chicago public school system, and you're going to continue losing generation after generation of kids who are relegated to that system, even though that's increasingly a smaller number.
Yeah, you know, Dan, let me make one final point. You know, what the Chicago Teachers Union is doing is racist, and it's sexist. Remember when they called the board's action racist and sexist? When you deny poor children choice, the overwhelming vast majority who are black and Latino, and when you confine them to failing neighborhood schools and they have no other alternative because of their income limitations, that is education redlining. That is institutional racism. And what they're doing is they're denying children their civil rights. You know, it is a civil right to have access of public education, and that's publicly funded education. And that should be publicly funded education, whether it's parochial schools or charter schools or private schools or traditional public schools. And that right is being denied. You know, you're at a point where you cannot deal with the Chicago Teachers Union. They are the Achilles heel for the city. And the sooner the elected officials in the city council and the legislature realize that this union is doing severe damage to the future of the city, the quicker they can take the type of action. And that action means you've got to liberate these kids. You've got to liberate the hostages. And the only way you do it is to provide them with educational choice. There's no alternative. Yeah.
Paul Vallis, former CPS superintendent and superintendent over in Louisiana and Philadelphia, all over the place. Maybe you'll come back from Texas and run for mayor again in 23. We'll see. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Dan, I was going to tell you, and the sad thing is we're finally at phase four. We should be having basketball tryouts today in high school, and they're not letting us. So anyway, Paul Vallis joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.